You are listening to National Security Law Today.
Hey, listeners, and welcome back to National Security Law Today. Last week, we aired part one of our conversation with journalist Timothy McLaughlin, whose reporting has closely followed developments in Myanmar's Kachin State. Alongside Elisa, Timothy discussed the country's political history, the rise of the Kachin Independence Army, and how their control of the Panghwa region has given them access to some of the world's most valuable rare earth minerals, right along China's border. This week, we bring you part two of that conversation. Timothy and Elisa shift focus to the ground-level realities of rare earth mining in Myanmar, the environmental toll of extraction, the lack of labor protections, and the logistics of moving these materials across the border. They also examine how these minerals make their way to Chinese processing facilities and why Myanmar's trade relationships and topography pose unique challenges to global supply chains. As always, thanks for tuning in, and here's Elisa.
Can we talk about just how this is being undertaken? What the heck are they doing to get this stuff out of the ground? It can't be good.
Yeah, so the type of mining that we see being used in Kachin State is called in-situ leaching. This is a type of way to remove rare earths from the ground without doing open pit mining, which if people are picturing it in their mind, they're probably picturing this big open pit with trucks driving around. That takes a lot of time and takes a lot of upfront capital. In-situ leaching doesn't take that much upfront money, and it's fairly quick to deploy. It's also, as you mentioned, ruinous to the environment. So in kind of brief, what happens is prospectors go out and they're looking for taking soil samples and testing them to see what type of rare earths are in the soil in various hills in Kachin State, where the topography is quite mountainous, quite hilly. When they find an area or a promising small mountain, they go about putting boreholes in the top of them, dozens and dozens and dozens of boreholes, which they line with essentially PVC pipe.
These aren't little holes. You know, it's not like you're setting a fence post, right? They're pretty good size.
They're actually not all that big. They're fairly small. And then what they do is they drip a mixture of leaching agent with like little spigots almost into these pipes. And the leaching agent is a mix of water and fertilizer, essentially commercial fertilizer. So interestingly, if you look at the import and export data from Myanmar, one of their biggest imports from China is fertilizer. And the fertilizer amount that's coming in far outstrips the farming that's happening in the country. And that's because a lot of this fertilizer is being used to make leaching agent. Mm. So this leaching agent is dripped into the ground. Gravity pulls it underground through the soil. And as it goes, it is washing out the rare earths, right? And then to ensure that they're collecting all of that rare earth rich liquid, they are drilling other holes at the bottom, much larger tunnels, which you're talking about, at the bottom of these hills, and then washing through them with river water. And then this all runs down into these big collection tanks. They look like industrial swimming pools. To these swimming pools, they add a set of chemicals that makes the rare earth settle at the bottom of the pool. And then they drain off the excess water, and it leaves behind this sludge. And the sludge is then put into buckets, and it's cooked in wood furnaces, wood-powered furnaces, like a massive, almost pizza oven. When that's finished cooking, what you have left over is this brown, reddish dust, and that's the rare earth oxides. That's put into bags, like big rice sacks, and that's driven across the border into China, where it's further refined.
Why China? Yeah. What is the topography there? Why can't they take it the other way into Myanmar, into the interior, if you will, and maybe so, get it somewhere and sell it to a different customer than China?
So much like most countries, Myanmar has no ability to refine this material once it gets to this stage, right? And this is part of, I think, again, the wider picture here in terms of the U.S., in terms of China, in terms of the trade war, is that China has a almost complete control over the refining aspect of this process and the production of magnets and other things that rare earth elements are used for. So China's really the only game in town. Even if it could go somewhere else, you know, the topography of Myanmar, the current fighting, the logistics of getting there would be an absolute nightmare. Really, China's it's
and
easily reachable.
No infrastructure, right? I mean, they don't have trains or highways.
No.
None of that.
There wouldn't be any way to move it. So China, it's obviously close and it's easy to get it there. And it's also the place, fortunately for the KIA and for whoever controls these mines, they are only a few miles from a country that has all the refining capabilities. And so it just needs to make a short hop across the border before it goes into this magnets and then makes it into kind of the global, you know, market. And I should go back to the rare earth removal process, to the leaching.
Yeah. There,
because you probably heard me mention water quite a bit.
A lot of water. Yeah. The images in the article were just unsettling, I think.
I think the main issue is that this water, after it's being used and being filled with leaching agent, is going back into the local tributaries, rivers, in Kachin State. That's flowing then down through various communities and small villages and towns, and the water is being, you know, highly, highly polluted. There's a research now from universities in Thailand who have gotten some of these water samples. And then on top of that, washing out, as you can imagine, the interior of a mountain with water causes stability issues. So there's often cave-ins and collapses. You know, people die in these mines, in the tunnels, with some, I guess, troubling frequency. And so this is becoming sort of an international issue as well. There's been a lot of concern recently in Thailand, a lot of civil society groups and the government raising this problem, right? That these pollutants are washing from Myanmar into other countries. So I think there's this international aspect of it that we're seeing now as well.
And this is highly carcinogenic stuff. Heavy metals are toxic, brain injuries and all sorts of things from them, right?
Right. Yeah. So it's not just it's the remnants of the rare earths. It's the mass amounts of fertilizer that have been used to make the leaching agent. All of this stuff is running into the water. So you have villagers reporting like fish die off, small animals dying, polluted water, you know, things become undrinkable, you know, environmentally very catastrophic situation. And this also links to your original question of how this started in Myanmar. And part of the reason this started in Myanmar, maybe the main reason, is because China really clamped down on this type of mining. In 2010, 2011, China said, enough. It's too environmentally disastrous. It was becoming a domestic issue in China. They were going to spend billions of dollars to clean up these sites. So they closed a lot of these mines. And the miners were looking for somewhere else to go. And the world was looking for these minerals still. And so that's how it sort of migrated from southern China across the border into Myanmar, where there was no regulations, there was no environmental impact assessment, there was no overarching authority telling them what they could and couldn't do. So really, this is the environmental concerns in China have pushed this into Myanmar.
So can we hit pause on that? Because I don't know, things like, what is the literacy rate in Kachin State? Are there alternative employers? Do the mines, for example, employ women who might otherwise have to turn to, say, sex work or something super unappealing? And are they paying the miners well enough that they're just, you know, forget it, I've got to feed my family, I'll do what I have to do type of situation?
So the big change came following the coup in 2021, right? Because the economy of Myanmar sort of, which was already reeling from COVID, unstable currency, and a few other things, you know, the coup really tanked the Myanmar economy. And when that happened, you had a lot of people going looking for jobs. And so there is a glut of workers, and many of them, through word of mouth and social media, made their way to Kachin State because they knew that there were these mines there. And so it's sort of chicken and egg. Like, did the mines, you know, start expanding a lot after 2021? Because of, you know, the amount of people, or did they have plans to expand before and then the workers kind of showed up? So anyway, what we see in 2021 is this glut of workers end up in Kachin working at the mines because of the economy of Myanmar. And so around that time, the miners that we interviewed for the story talk about the labor conditions getting worse, the pay getting worse, because there were so many workers now that were sort of disposable in a way. You know, it's a mix of people. Some of them come from other parts of Kachin. Some of them come from other parts of Myanmar to work in this area. Almost all of them are migrant laborers who are moving there to work in these mining operations. The pay varies based on the position. Some of the complaints that we heard and that have been documented by CSOs are that the managers of the hierarchy are people from China. And that there's a feeling amongst a lot of Kachin people that, you know, they're not getting paid, you know, as much as the Chinese workers, that they're getting the more dangerous jobs, you know, that their working conditions are worse. So, yeah, I think there's this division there as well.
Yeah, I wonder, you know, we've got Chinese managers just a few miles to the Chinese border. I have to wonder how much the KIA might actually be able to dispense, function a bit of Robin Hood here. It makes me wonder how much China actually controls this. Was there anything in particular that you encountered that suggested one way or another what China's involvement might be, other than managerial roles and sending workers? Yeah. I mean, they send them all over the world. They're all over Africa. You can see them everywhere you go. Right.
You know, with China, I think they were quite happy before December, November 2024, when the KIA took over this area. They were okay working with the previous group, with the NDAK, because they were aligned with the Myanmar military. Following the coup, Beijing sort of sat on the fence a little bit. They were not happy with the coup taking place in Myanmar. Beijing had spent a lot of time and a lot of energy and a lot of effort getting to know the NLD, becoming friendly with a group that they had shunned for a long time. You know, they took lots of NLD. This is Suu Kyi's party, the National League for Democracy. They took a lot of NLD leaders to China. You know, they put a lot of effort into building up relations, you know, across a broader swath of Myanmar rather than just dealing with the military. I think they were quite happy for the most part with where things were in Myanmar. The coup, they could not have been happy about it. It just made this country on their border extremely unstable. It's not just rare earths that are in Myanmar that are important to China. They have a massive gas pipeline that runs across the country. They have huge plans for building parts of BRI through Myanmar. They are interested in multiple infrastructure projects there. You know, this is a country that they see as sort of a gateway out of Asia a little bit, right? They can bypass the Straits of Malacca if they use some of the shipping terminals there. So strategically, very important place for China. There's just no way that Beijing was pleased with the coup happening. It's incredibly destabilizing. It creates a massive kind of turbulent country on their border, which they just do not want. And so they were happy in the previous iteration of dealing with the group that was there before, which was aligned with the Myanmar military. I think they were fine kind of doing business with them. The KIA is a bit of a spoiler for Beijing because they are not as close to China. They are not aligned with the Myanmar military. So you have this very interesting situation where Chinese companies are buying rare earths and sending the money to the KIA, which is fighting the Myanmar military, which Beijing now backs, right? So now they find themselves on both sides of this conflict. And so I think this situation is not great for them. They're not happy about it. So they have pressured and tried to get the KIA to sign ceasefire deals to stop fighting, to stop their offensive across Kachin. China is undoubtedly the biggest and most important foreign policy kind of player in Myanmar, especially now. And so, yes, this is like important to them because of the minerals. It's also important to them because of the bigger picture and the bigger way in which they see Myanmar helping their geostrategic interests. So I think that Beijing is aware that this is an unstable situation, that they're not quite sure how to deal with the KIA, that the KIA have not been super close with them in the past. So I think they're also looking for alternative sources of this material.
Well, you know, talking about China and their relationship, and you can see that. I mean, I know they've said at least publicly a couple times that one reason why they tolerate North Korea at all is because they don't want massive migration flows into the country that could be destabilizing and, you know, some other things. They seem to cultivate these relationships. I guess Myanmar, would this be part of their potential buffer if they ever had a conflict with India? I don't know. Proximate to Bangladesh as they are and, you know, South Asia.
Yeah. You know, I think the old days before the current military dictatorship, they had shunned, you know, Suu Kyi and shunned the National League for Democracy and were kind of the main backer of the various military regimes that came and went in Myanmar. We saw that change in early, probably 2011, 2012. I think they started realizing that the Myanmar military was not going to be in quite as strong a position as it was previously, you know, with them allowing this quasi-civilian government to take root. So yeah, I think China's spent an enormous amount of time and resources and people kind of building up these networks and friendships with other groups in the country. Before COVID shut the world down, you know, Xi Jinping's last trip was to Myanmar, right? And he met Suu Kyi and then he flew back to China and then he didn't leave for many years because of COVID, right? Post-coup, China was not totally behind the Myanmar military. They were very much, I think, on the fence. They were not giving them the full-throated support. They held out some votes at the UN. They did some things that I think surprised people. I think people thought they would immediately just kind of fall in line behind the junta, and they haven't done that. They really didn't do that until maybe last year. And that's when I think there were concerns about the durability of the Myanmar military. They were losing a lot of ground in a lot of places. They were taking some big battlefield losses. And I think the number one key concern for Beijing is Myanmar essentially splintering apart on its border, to have this Syria-like situation, this broken apart country on its border, to them is the worst case scenario. And so they started backing the Myanmar military when it became clear that they were struggling, that they were kind of having issues controlling parts of territory. They were taking losses. And that's when I think China really got off the fence and said, yeah, we're going to get behind these guys. Not so much because they love them and support them and believe what they're doing. Mostly it's self-preservation. They do not want a splintered, fractured, broken apart, totally shambolic country existing on the border of China. It just does not make strategic sense for them.
I want to talk about the relationship between the United States now, modernly, and Myanmar, and whether or not they've ever been a reliable partner to the United States. Because, you know, I think these minerals are heavily coveted here. I can only imagine, because we continue to purchase so much from China. I think you looked into this. Some of these things that are coming out of this sort of hellscape and toxin and, you know, sort of sounding like exploitation of various desperate ethnic groups or people who need to make the money, those things are ending up in China, but then they're ending up here, right? In the United States.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. They're ending up around the world in, you know, various products that people use. The U.S. relationship with Myanmar during the Obama years and the outreach to kind of these pariah states, right? Cuba, Iran, Myanmar. And then there was the overlapping, I think, agenda initiative there, which was the pivot to Asia, and Myanmar kind of fell into both these places. You also had personalities in the White House who seemed to have like a deep personal interest in Myanmar, right? Jake Sullivan knew a lot about the country. Ben Rhodes is very interested in the country. Kirk Campbell is very interested in the country. So there was a huge amount of interest during the Obama years of Myanmar. And that kind of, you know, at the time, the country was taking these nascent steps to kind of change its governance, right? Kind of coming out of this years of being a full military dictatorship. The U.S. had put some extremely harsh sanctions on Myanmar during the Bush years. I think there was a thought within some parts of D.C. that those weren't working, right? They weren't changing the military government. The government was still very durable. The country was extremely poor and underdeveloped.
It was the efficacy of Cuba sanctions, right?
Yes. So there was questions about sort of what are we trying to accomplish here, right? And so there was a change in strategy. And so there was a huge amount of attention paid to the country. I'm sure you remember, you know, Obama visited twice. Hillary Clinton went when she was Secretary of State. John Kerry went. There was just a huge amount of intrigue and interest from the United States that I think this could be like a really big foreign policy kind of win for the U.S., right? And again, it was part of this bigger look towards Asia. Ensuing years, obviously, the Myanmar military carried out what's been described as, you know, a genocidal campaign against the Rohingya. Suu Kyi kind of stood up, went to The Hague and defended the military. Things got, frankly, just a lot more complicated. Trump administration one came in and didn't have the same interest in the country. Biden came into office. You know, obviously, there was COVID going on. You know, the country, I think, is not of the same sort of agenda item or interest, you know, that it was, say, 10 years ago. There's just no way that it ranks kind of in that way, right? I think the rare earths sort of plot line has made it more interesting again in DC. We see some pieces recently from various people talking about the U.S. should engage with Myanmar more and try, you know, to build some relationships and try to kind of have its way or get these minerals through various ways. There's two issues. If you put one aside, which is that why you should be engaging with the countries to get, you know, some of its strategic assets? But, you know, the second thing is just technical. I just don't see a way in which the U.S. could get this stuff and get it out of the country or find an alternative to China the way that if they could even, you know, it's just like such a volatile, such a remote, such a politically unstable, and not just politically, just armed group unstable situation. So there's just a huge amount of issues in terms of change and kind of the future. If we want to look forward a little bit, you know, as I mentioned earlier, I think there is some hope among some people that the KIA will be more receptive to people's demands over environmental concerns and things like that. The other thing is you see a lot of innovation in the rare earth space, and there might come a time in the distant or not so distant future when these rare earths are not needed for these magnets, when there's new magnets that are made that are perform well enough that you don't need these. Some companies are already developing those or already touting those. You know, we've seen some major announcements on that front. this is the thing with the history of rare earths, right? That they are super important, needed at one time, and then they can vanish again because the technology advances and they're not needed again. Right now, the people that I spoke to for the story, you know, a lot of them point out, because of, you know, the instability of the situation and how difficult it is to get this stuff, China's obviously controls. They've, you know, muscled the US a couple of times now on this. Maybe innovation is the way to go. Maybe we innovate our way out of this problem by creating magnets that don't need as much rare earths or don't need a specific kind of rare earths. So I think the future, it's obviously very uncertain in Kachin. It's also very uncertain kind of globally as to the demand of these things and kind of what tech might lead us to.
Yeah, it's true. Historically, we have innovated ourselves out of the brink of disaster. I have to say, the piece is really something. I would commend this to people. I think you should read it. I would encourage you to go ahead and crank out a book here. I do think this is a big issue. I also think it's just a terrific metaphor, because I felt like, as I was reading your piece, I was thinking of like Dune. Some of these books that contain these like lessons about our dependence on something that brings us to have to challenge all of our existing values, right? Whatever it is.
Yeah.
We've got to go get this thing out of the ground on some planet somewhere because we need it.
Yeah. You know,
who cares what human rights violations, who cares how sick everybody's getting doing it? And then we do historically kind of innovate our way back to a center. I just found the piece really great, and I was super glad that I chanced on it. And I was super glad that your editor at Bloomberg happens to have been a prior podcast guest of ours.
Yes.
Matt Campbell. And that's
Where
you ran it, because you write for The Atlantic too, right?
Yes, I do. I do. I'm glad you enjoyed it. I think you summed it up. It's just this very intriguing part of the world that has become sort of all of a sudden globally important in a way that it never was before. I certainly hope it maybe sparks some interest for other people in, you know, not just rare earths, but Myanmar and kind of all this stuff.
And it was a great metaphor for sort of the complexity of the national security issues that we're facing. You know, if we really have to have this stuff and it's on China's border, we can't just send the military in to do this, right? You know, and our dependence and supply chain thing, I think for the average American, supply chain wasn't the first thing they thought about until, you know, you couldn't even get a mask during COVID.
Yeah.
Because they all came from China, and people were like, oh, that's supply chain. Okay, now I get it.
Yeah.
Or I can't get my car fixed because this part is only manufactured in X and that place has tumbled into conflict. These are significant things, right? I thought it was, if you were a national security lawyer, just look at the various issues that we've talked about in this series. You know, think about safety and dealing with militias who have, you know, dubious human rights records, which you'd have to do in a lot of places. My dog's even upset about that. You know, there's sort of the issue of dealing with foreign governments generally. And what's the government? If you're the company who's trying to work something out, who the heck's the government? And who's it going to be tomorrow? I mean, you talk about China having to court these things with all their vast resources. Imagine any individual company in this space that's, you know, trying to demonstrate they're going to make a return on investment. And this is a good capital expenditure. Who are they even talking to get to yes? And then all of these toxins, what is the ultimate potential liability and what is the reputational damage to any company that's allowing this kind of, frankly, toxic and dangerous mining to take place? You don't want to be the company that has disintegrated an entire culture. It's a challenge for the United States. You need this stuff. It's ending up in China. We feel like we're losing a trade war, and now we've got to negotiate tariffs with them, but they're holding the spice melange. How do we get there?
Yeah, I mean, there's a huge, like you said, slew of questions surrounding all of this stuff. Some of it was a bit, you know, foretold. I think some people in the U.S. government and outside the government were sort of waving the red flag about this and China's and an overdependence on China about this 20 plus years ago. You know, obviously those warnings, it was a different time. And I think those warnings were probably not taken as seriously as they should be, as we see now. But yeah, I mean, for Southeast Asia, for this part of the world, you know, for these sort of, you know, mining operations, yeah, I mean, all the stuff you touched on, it's just a huge sort of tangled web of, you know, geopolitical interests of, you know, in Myanmar, of armed groups, of ethnic relations, of the, you know, broader kind of anti-junta democracy struggle that's going on. So yeah, I mean, very sort of fascinating thing to kind of watch play out.
Yeah, definitely. But I really appreciate the piece, and I'm super glad you came to talk to us tonight.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
And thank you for listening to National Security Law Today. This is Business and National Security Law Today. And we just want to ask you, if you're our listeners, remember to subscribe to NSLT. Be sure to give us a rating on your listening app of choice. Like and share this podcast with other people who might be interested. We're committed to bringing you cost-free, intelligent content that will enrich you and train you to think critically about issues, something that is definitely lost when you're death scrolling. And remember, we cover issues in a series. So if you like hearing about energy, if you like hearing about this topic now, and you recognize that it's always a big fight, it's always what people fight over. If you look at the history of battle, you may want to go back and listen to some of our earlier podcasts in this series, which deal with a lot of the other issues, including from, you know, nuclear scientists and people who understand energy far better than I will. A lot of lawyers go to law school because they're not super great at math, but we bring it to you anyway. Thanks for listening. Remember, if you want to reach out to us, you always can. You can reach us at natsec@americanbar.org if you want, or you can hit us up on social media. Our writer, producer, and host is me, Elisa Poteet, but I'm always here in my individual capacity. Our editor, my co-producer, is Francis Burkham. My other co-producer / producers is Holly McMahon, along with all of the members of the Standing Committee on Law and National Security, without whom this podcast would not be possible. We'll see you next time for more on energy.
The views expressed on National Security Law Today have not been approved by the House of Delegates or the Board of Governors of the American Bar Association, and this recording should not be construed as representing ABA policy.